From KMUW Wichita.
From Toronto, Ontario.
And from Armilla, Spain.
This is You're Saying It Wrong. Let's talk words. Let's talk controversy. People are always getting upset about one thing or another. We'll wade into a few of them. I'm Fletcher Powell, host and producer at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas. And joining me, as they do each week, language experts and New York Times best-selling authors, Kathy Petras and Ross Petras. Hi, Kathy. Hi, Ross. Before we jump into today, I just want to thank Ninky333, who left a review for us on the Apple Podcasts platform, says, "What fun! This is such an entertaining show." Thank you to Ninky333 and everyone else who leaves a review. And also, I should warn people that if you don't enjoy laughing or having fun, this is probably not the show for you. Someone else left a negative review a while back that complained that we laugh too much, which is okay, sure. Move along then, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, so please leave us positive reviews and just, you know, move along quietly if you hate fun and learning things.
Now I'm not going to laugh ever again.
Oh, man. Anyway, last week we teased this topic for today a little bit when we talked about farther and further and the distinction between the two and whether we even need to make a distinction between the two. I won't rehash that because if you didn't hear that, you should go back and listen to last week's episode. So today we're going to continue on with grammar controversies along the lines of farther and further.
Correct. But first, we have I have a question. This is actually a serious topic. But here's the question. Do you know the definition of book drenching?
Drenching. Book drenching, as in making a book very, very wet. Yes?
Possibly, but not quite. This was a very serious and to us horrifying new word. Or the definition of the new word was, the new two words was horrifying, the new phrase.
Wow. Is this a new phrase or is this just something you just learned about? Oh, it's new. Okay.
It's a new phrase, but it's a phrase referring to a new tendency that's going on.
I think it's so bogus. Let's start with that.
A new trend. It's all over the place, apparently, in all these style magazines.
Okay, now what they're saying is the application of book drenching fundamentally alters the sensory experience of a room. Its impact extends beyond the purely visual, affecting the space's acoustics, perceived warmth, and overall character. By turning a flat, static wall into a deep, textured surface, the technique introduces a layer of complexity. This goes on and on and on. I'm going to stop right here and basically say, they say the idea is not merely to display books, but to use their collective mass to define a space. It is not about a few neatly arranged stacks or a well-ordered shelf. It is about scale. And so basically it's about like a lot of books, right?
But, yeah, and you can see behind me, Fletcher, if anyone has a camera. I have a book-drenched room.
But
I like to read those books, and I got them to read. And I did not get them to create a space. I think I'm an inadvertent book drencher.
But you have introduced a layer of complexity.
I have. And I actually went to a couple times when I've had radio people in here, they've commented that the acoustics are really good because indeed they do create. But it just horrified us, the idea increasingly of using books as using the idea of reading and basically taking away from reading and using it essentially as a design thing. And I'm going to make one minor comment. It really horrified me years ago. I was at a rare bookstore in New York, Strand Bookstore, upstairs. And one of the daughter of the owner was getting into doing book drenching, selling books as basically, quote, modular building blocks for creating atmosphere. That's one of the definitions.
Yeah, it was books by the yard. They sold them as.
Books by the yard. And someone came in and they bought a yard and a half of books. And they were vellum-covered books. And there was another yard next to that it was from the same set. And I realized, oh my God, those are Ovid, who is a really kind of cool writer in Latin, and that's a really good edition. It's, I think it was the, whatever, you don't care enough the edition.
No, we don't, Ross. It's
so anyway, I said, you know, I just noticed that person there bought a yard and a half of books. Could I buy the next yard for me? And she goes, oh, what do you want them for? I said, well, you know, to read them. And she goes, oh, we can't sell them to you for reading. We can sell them to you for... by the yard. So you, for reading, you have to go to this really cool guy who was the rare book curator there. And so I went, and he was saying, you know, it was $400. I said, well, the guy bought him for decoration for like 30. How come I can't have him for 30? So then I went to the daughter of the owner. I complained. I said, you know, you just sold those for 30, and I have like even fewer books. And she goes, oh no, but you want them for reading, so we have to charge you the
another
price. And that, I thought, was the epitome and essence of book drenching.
Wow.
Well, have you guys seen the thing that, I mean, I see it in all my decorating sort of things, where two things, it's like people who, you arrange your books by color, not by topic or anything.
Yeah, sure.
And the other one that drives me crazy, though, is when you do them face out, like the spine is against the wall.
Oh.
So that way you have a neutral.
But how do you know?
Oh my God.
How do you know what books you have?
Well, apparently it does not matter, Fletcher, because you're drenching. For God's sakes, get with the program. We're drenching here.
Anyway, that horrified us, and we were not laughing when we read that. So
we are now, Seth.
We're crying then.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, wow.
We're going on to the controversies. These are now things that really aren't controversial, but some people get hot under the collar about them. You don't want to start with this one, Ross?
Okay, we'll start with it. I was reading a book the other day, and it mentioned Martin, and I'm not sure this is true, but it mentioned Martin Amis, the writer, and the statement was made that he hated using the word dilapidated except in the technical Latin sense. We were talking about decimated before, remember?
Oh, right.
And he said dilapidated because lapis in Latin refers to stones. You should only use dilapidated when you refer, for example, a dilapidated building is only accurate if you refer to a stone building.
Oh, what, it can't be just a building you threw stones at?
Well, technically, actually, Kathy got into the Latin there because he's really wrong. He said the point would be lapis is Latin, therefore it refers to like de-stoned buildings. Therefore, you cannot use it for a dilapidated wooden farmhouse. Now, first of all, going back into the Latin, which we did, and Kathy quickly showed that, the original Latin was actually throwing stones at.
Oh, my God.
Apparently.
Yeah.
We're not sure. So even that's wrong. But it goes back to basically the ridiculousness of looking. Etymology is fun, but overdoing etymology is dumb.
Yeah.
Let's just stick with the common English definition.
Right.
I just like shut up and relax. You know what I mean?
Right.
Dilapidated.
My goodness.
But this is like, well, we've all talked about this, the three of us, how each one of us has gotten a little more relaxed about correcting and so on. Mm-hmm. I think we all have. I mean, we each have our bugbears.
Sure.
Which is, where did bugbear come from? I have no idea. But on the whole, I think we've gotten a lot more relaxed. But a lot of people haven't. I mean, I think that all of us have seen the myriad of grammar groups or like on Facebook or on Reddit or on Instagram where it's like, haha, look at this horrible sign I found that has like a typo, you know, and everyone laughs and gets irritated.
You know, it's funny. Somebody listening right now, And I think you've demonstrated before that this is incorrect, but someone is going to be mad that you just said myriad of.
I'm sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You're absolutely right.
I'm one who does just, I would have just said myriad websites or whatever you were talking about. But as you told me, myriad of is actually totally fine.
One of my bugbears is whence. Whence. I mean, when people use, you know, whence from or whence when, et cetera.
From whence.
As opposed to whence. Yeah. But I mean, I think a lot of times we're getting more and more. I mean, Kathy and I think both have gotten much more liberal in terms of, because we both started out pretty much as fairly rigid grammar Nazis, I think, and we've changed a lot. But here's one from, I'm not going to call this person a grammar Nazi, but
we got an email. Go, Ross.
Okay, I'm going to read it. My wife returned from her job at the St. Louis County Public Library and plunked in front of me a copy of your book, That Doesn't Mean What You Think It Means. It is in the second paragraph of your introduction that you commit one of the most common errors of our time, and one that most frequently annoys me. Okay, we had said, according to surveys, dictionaries like Merriam-Webster, usage panels like the Heritage Panel, etc.
Uh-huh.
This is much like what today's journalists will do in saying things such as, in states like Texas. Okay, in the fifth paragraph of your introduction, you do the same thing using, this person was really parsing us here, using like words that are not... they're not like other words. You know, at the end of the paragraph, you correctly use such as when mentioning the New York Times and the Washington Post. Physician, heal thyself.
Don't do his name.
Sincerely,
I was really tempted when he did this to like answer back in Latin, because that physician, heal thyself, comes from a Latin, brilliant, whatever. But let's leave that.
So the deal is, okay, the deal with this, just really quickly, is that you were saying states like Texas when this person thinks that you should be saying states such as Texas, because otherwise, yes, you're saying states that are like Texas, but not necessarily Texas itself. That, I mean, okay, you go ahead. This is obviously nonsense.
Okay, it was interesting because, I mean, but all grammar in essence, to be fair to the individual, all grammar in essence is nonsense. There are basically arbitrary rules. I say cat, mm-hmm, you know, a French person says chat. I mean, we've decided basically on an idea. This is how you say things. This is how you put together words.
Yes.
However, in this case, and we have to, we've talked about this too, we have to be kind of loose with grammar, but we also have to be a little bit strict too. If I started talking, you know, using very bad grammar, you're going to have troubles understanding me, and it doesn't really work very well. However, in this case, it was really interesting. The idea of such as versus like basically seems to have taken hold in the mid 20th centuries. It's very recent, that distinction.
Wow, that recent?
Mm-hmm.
And even then, the two Fowler brothers, you know, famous for their concise Oxford Dictionary of Common English and all of their books, their first definition of like is such
not
as.
Their first. It's one of the definitions.
Oh, one of the definitions.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Kathy. You have corrected me. You're right.
I am at heart a copy editor. Yes.
And incidentally, the book was copy edited as well. So,
yeah. That's wild. I didn't realize it was such a recent distinction. As someone who knows that people write letters like that, especially to, mm-hmm, say public radio stations, when I have news copy in front of me, I will change like to such as.
That distinction can't, I mean, I know, we know the distinction. We like because it's chatty.
Yeah.
And we were deliberately doing the book. I mean, we are actually aware of it, but we deliberately do scattered them both because we like the sort of chatty nature to it. And we pick one or the other, mostly instinctively, when it just sounds better. And we found numerous examples in literature where like is used. There's an author, I'm not sure you know her, called Jane Austen.
Not familiar.
Never heard of her?
No.
Yeah, straightforward, open-handed man like Weston. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, she did it.
I mean, but ultimately, Russ, I'm going to use your argument here as, I mean, we always cite, there's always citations from famous authors, mm-hmm, doing one or the other. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can always pick someone to back your horse, if you will. Mm-hmm. I think to me, the thing is, it doesn't matter, this particular distinction. I mean, it doesn't alter the meaning one bit. I mean, not even a nuanced, does it? No.
No. And that leads us into our whole topic for the day. I mean, this was an example of someone citing us, and I understand the difference, but we don't feel that's an essential difference. We don't think it's worth arguing about, particularly because, I mean, it doesn't seem even that traditional in that sense. Mm-hmm. So you're not really violating tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to move on, and we come to our famous one. We've talked about it before, but we've heard a lot about it again. Split infinitives.
Oh, yes. Thou shalt not split infinitives is also a made-up rule, right? Because if I remember correctly, this is one of those deals where in the 17th or something century, a bunch of guys said English should be more like Latin, and in Latin you can't split an infinitive, probably because it's like, it's one word, right? An infinitive is probably, mm-hmm, one word in Latin.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas,
well, actually, I mean, that one, that kind of bothers me all the time when people say that, because Latin does have two future infinitive, for example, would be like, for, let's say, porto to carry would be portaturus esse, and the esse is a separate word. So you, I mean, technically, even when they say that, most Latin infinitives are one word and you can't split one word, but some are too. And you, they don't actually, to be fair though, they don't usually split those either. So,
yeah,
whatever.
Right. But so obviously in English, we can split an infinitive.
Yes.
Because
easily
we can show that to boldly go.
Yeah, well, that's always the best example. It's interesting, though, because it became, splitting infinitives was very common. It was like a normal form of a normal structure.
Mm-hmm.
And it was big at one point, then it became rarer. When did it, they reappeared in the 18th century. So you've got, like, at the beginning, split infinitives. Then you have a decline in split infinitives. King James Version of the Bible, no split infinitives. Rare in Samuel Johnson. Spencer, no. Dryden, no. Pope, no. John Donne, a little bit. Pepys, once. It's sort of odd that someone would count that only Pepys only had one, but whatever. And then they reappeared in the 18th century. Then the Victorians go, absolutely not. Big grammatical error. Let's go away again from it. So you have these, you know, hills and valleys all over the joint.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which is typical of a language. I mean, any language in humankind, it changes over time. I like the Fowler definition in modern English usage. They divided the English-speaking word into five classes based upon their attitude towards split infinitives. And I think we can argue this for almost every controversy in grammar. Number one is those who neither care nor know what a split infinitive is, and generally are just happy folk. Those who do not know but care very much. Those who avoid them blindly based on tame acceptance of the misinterpreted opinions of others. Three, those who know and condemn.
Mm-hmm.
Four, those who know and approve. Those who choose deliberately to split, often rejecting the trammels of convention. Oh. And those who know and distinguish, those who analyze, often called discriminate or distinguishers, who recognize that some splits are better than others based upon clarity and style.
Yeah.
And that was the ideal. We all want to be number five.
Yes, yes.
Or number one. I would say five or one.
I kind of like the happy folk.
I also kind of like the people who do it on purpose. Number four, I think that was, to stick it to everybody else.
Yeah. The trammels of convention. They avoid that.
Yeah.
Yes.
It is so odd to me, though, that this is such a bone of contention with so many. I genuinely don't see why you get so hot under the collar about what to me is so minor.
Well,
do you guys?
I'll tell you why I used to, is because it made me feel superior.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought I knew something and other people were screwing it up. I mean, that's why I used to get bothered by it. Like, at its root. I don't think I could have told you that at the time. But, you know, as I've said before, that's no real way to live your life. And I feel a lot better about things now. So
it is. I agree.
It's true. It's funny because, I mean, I'm just glancing through all of our notes. And one of the earliest printed instances is from Alford. We've talked about Henry Alford before, who's the guy in the 1800s, wrote a book called The Queen's English, and where he laid out his rules and everybody sort of followed. And the interesting thing with the split infinity, he was very against it. A lot of writers at the time said, that's ridiculous, Henry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we think it's fine. But for whatever reason, it caught on. It's like everybody thought, well, if Henry Alford says so, it must be true. And teachers are still teaching it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I like I don't remember who said it now. I would love to give the person credit who said, I don't just split infinitives, I smash them.
He's a number four.
The next one is Kathy's bugbear, to use that word, which I think it was like, I think it's like the bogeyman type thing, Kathy, incidentally. I didn't mention that.
Oh, bugbear?
The bugbear. Yeah, I think. We can check it. But anyway, Kathy will constantly scream at me about, not that I do it or don't do it, but Kathy just like screams when everyone mentions this.
Oxford comma.
Oh, yeah.
This is Kathy's bugbear with people citing it all the time. Do you know anything? Always use the Oxford comma. Kath goes, no, you don't have to. You don't have to. And I'm going to leave the rest. I'm not going to let Kathy go with this one.
Thank you. This is a pet peeve of mine because everywhere you turn, anyone, it seems, that's interested in language in the English language mentions the Oxford comma, and it's like, oh my God, it's like I would never go out with somebody who doesn't know how to use an Oxford comma, or you know what I mean? Or like, Oxford comma. It's groups like protect the Oxford comma. It's not even a real rule. It's grammatically optional. The Oxford comma is it's not grammatically correct. It's not grammatically incorrect, but it's it could be either.
I'm going to interrupt you here, Kathy. One second in defense of the Oxford comma. I agree it can be either. And sometimes I think, well, first of all, we should define an Oxford comma.
Oh, yes, thank you. Sorry.
Why don't you define it, and then I'll throw it.
Oxford comma is also called a serial comma. The technical definition, it's the comma used after the penultimate item in a list of three or more items, before the and or the or. So you would have like Fletcher, comma, Ross, comma, Kathy, comma, and her cats.
Right. Or alternatively, Fletcher, comma, Ross, comma, Kathy and her cats.
Yes.
Right. No comma after Kathy. So I guess that's where the decision comes in, is whether you're going to put that comma there.
My irritation is the fact that these there's this, like, not a handful of people, it's like people that seem to think it's a crime against punctuation to not use an Oxford comma.
Right.
And my argument is that, okay, yes, there are instances where I think it makes it clear. We go back to what is punctuation for? What is grammar for? What is language for? It's to communicate. It doesn't matter if you're not using. It doesn't mean that you're a moron who doesn't know that there should be a comma there, because there doesn't have to be one there. And that's why I get really hot under the collar with the people who have that, like, how dare you not use one? And I will stand on that hill.
So in your personal writing, what do you do, Kathy? Just without regard to what anybody else gets mad about, what do you usually do?
I think I actually use it a fair amount.
Yeah,
frankly.
I don't think you get stressed out about it, though. I think you're right. You do.
Yeah, I use it quite often. I think I probably use it more often than not.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what about this one? This is a famous example that it's always up everywhere. This book is dedicated to my parents, comma, Ayn Rand and God.
Ayn Rand.
Ayn Rand and God.
Very good, Kathy. Yeah, you could argue it's necessary there. Obviously, your parents are probably not Ayn Rand and God. And so, a kind of extreme example, but let's say it said, my parents, Ayn Rand, and I don't know, Arthur Miller.
Yeah, right. That's a case where you probably, I mean, the God makes it funny, but you're right. That one, it could be confusing.
But I mean, I think that it's like, but really, you're going to know. I see, I go back to, I maybe I have more faith in the masses. I would think that most people reading it would know that your parents probably weren't Arthur Miller and Ayn Rand.
What if it's, this is dedicated to my parents, Chuck and Georgia?
I agree with that. I was just about to say the same thing. That one, I think you would put it in. You'd put the, because you would think that you want to make sure that Georgia and Chuck aren't your parents.
Right.
Okay. I'll give you that. But I'm saying, I just don't think it's quite as a marker of intelligence or literacy that people are making it. And I think that's my pet peeve.
You know, AP style is not to use that comma. And so, you know, I'm reading news stories all the time that don't have that comma in them, and it's, you know, 99.5% of the time it's perfectly clear. I do use it just personally because I always have, and I just keep doing it, and that's fine unless I'm forced not to because I'm writing AP style copy.
Yeah, that's right. Because Chicago uses it, AP doesn't, right? Isn't that it? Yeah,
I think that's it. Yeah, Chicago does say it, I think. But here we go with grammar again, though, in terms of usage. Fletcher earlier on said, if it was for a very hypothetical situation.
Yeah, I'm sure I did. Yeah.
And it should have been technically, it should have been if it were. Mm-hmm. Now, none of us really stopped. We had no problem understanding Fletcher.
Well, I was actually a little wounded by it, but I didn't want to say anything.
Kathy threw a fit up of coffee. Yeah. I could see you going, ah. No, but kidding aside, that's what I think that sort of epitomizes all of what we're talking about here. We're talking about rules that generally don't really make any difference in terms of hearing, in terms of listening, in terms of understanding, or in terms really of even elegance. I don't think that saying, I use the subjunctive all the time, but I don't think not using the subjunctive is particularly egregiously bad.
Yeah.
What fascinated me, I found that the Oxford comma isn't as widely used in Great Britain. It's a very American punctuation.
That's funny.
And here we call it Oxford, and everybody's like, ooh, Oxford.
Yeah, I think we're actually classy.
Yeah, you know?
We're like, doing that fake British accent.
And they're busy going, yeah, and they're busy going, what idiots?
Those colonials? Yeah, I know.
Yeah, right.
Maybe it's become, the Oxford, Mississippi comma.
Yeah.
I was going to say, but now, did Faulkner use the Oxford?
No, we should check that. Now we're going to come to a word that I, talking about controversy, I can't help it. I hate this word.
Mm.
And regardless of everyone saying irregardless, mm-hmm. I just said regardless.
Mm-hmm.
I did not say irregardless because I hate it.
Mm-hmm.
Kath, do you want to expound on that?
Okay, well, I want to hear Fletcher's take on it. Fletcher, how do you feel about irregardless?
How do I feel about it is that I also hate it. I mm-hmm. recognize all of the things we're about to say about it, but I am mm-hmm. with Ross in that it's like nails on a chalkboard to me.
Yep, same with me.
I don't like it as much as you guys, oddly enough. I don't like it, but what got me, though, is I didn't realize, I assumed irregardless was a fairly new construct. It appeared back in the 1800s. Mm. You started having irregardless mm-hmm. as a widely used word.
Actually, I'm gonna correct you, Kathy. Merriam-Webster says the first known use was 1795. We're scraping 1800 when we got a little bit in.
The other thing is most people seem to think that it was like sort of like a rural kind of like irregardless thing. It was a city thing. It was mainly used. They found most of the earliest occurrences in New York City and in Massachusetts. I'm assuming Boston and stuff.
Just in case people need it explained, the word should just be regardless. And when you put the IR in front of it, it I guess should probably make it not regardless, which is
not regardless. Yeah, exactly.
Which is not what you mean.
No.
But we have talked about prefixes that become intensifiers or emphasizers, mm-hmm. right? And
yes.
And basically
like
make
inflammable.
Right.
Have,
they
right.
basically make the word mean the same thing they mean. They just don't do anything, and this sort of thing happens over time. My assumption has always been that people say irregardless because of the word irrespective.
Exactly.
Yes, that's exactly what most people think. It's a blend of irrespective and regardless. So it's an emphatic.
Yeah.
The interesting thing, though, is the in like the etymological dictionaries, they're saying the in here means the opposite of, as Fletcher just said.
Mm-hmm.
Yet when they do the inflammable, they say the in, which is correct. In Latin, in can mean various things. And they're saying their in is an intensifier.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, how do they know that irrespective
is a not?
Is an, yeah.
Good question.
And not just a,
and
I don't know.
Let's explain also, Ross said in, I-N, but that in, that N can change into an R because of what's coming
yes.
after it. Yeah.
Assimilation, right. Yeah. Anyway, irregardless or regardless of how you feel.
I think we know.
We'd love to hear your take on other grammatical controversies.
Yeah.
Which ones drive you nuts? Which ones don't bother you at all? Which ones should we talk about? Let us know.
I got to say one final thing, though, is the people always use it's in the dictionary as their explanation for why we can use irregardless. And we've touched this before, and I just have to toss it in. That's not an excuse. It's in the dictionary. Doesn't mean it's a great word, okay? That's all.
You're Saying It Wrong is part of the NPR network and is produced in the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas by me, Fletcher Powell. Kathy Petrus records from her home in Armilla, Spain. Ross Petrus from his home in Toronto, Ontario in Canada. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. Our digital team is Beth Golay and Carly Cooper. Carly Cooper is also our video editor. You can subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can find all of our past episodes by subscribing to the You're Saying It Wrong podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, or by visiting us at kmuw.org. If you have a question for Kathy and Ross, if you'd like to suggest a topic or you just want to reach out, you can email me at powell@kmuw.org. Or email them at kandrpetrus@gmail.com. You can also record a voice memo of yourself asking your question. You might get your voice heard on air. Or you can download the KMUW app and press the Talk to Us button. You can find Kathy and Ross's books pretty much anywhere you get books, and a handful of them are also available on audiobook, read by the authors themselves. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.